From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Senate, on Tuesday, passed a sweeping criminal justice reform bill with bipartisan support. The House had already passed a version of the bill, which extensively revises prison and sentencing guidelines. The president's support of the bill, called the First Step Act, resulted from an unlikely scenario. Pressure from his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as well as the liberal CNN commentator Van Jones and the reality TV star Kim Kardashian, who used the case of a 63-year-old woman named Alice Marie Johnson to change Donald Trump's mind. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reluctantly backed the bill in turn and got it passed through the Senate 87-12, with some conservative Republicans refusing to support it. Trump is expected to sign the bill into law this week. My guest is Jesselyn McCurdy. She's the deputy director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. Welcome to the program, Jesselyn.
Thank you for having me.
So this bill is sort of a surprise to many of us who hadn't been even paying really much attention to it. There have been efforts to reform the federal criminal justice system for years, including under President Obama. First, let's talk about what's in the bill before we get to how we get here. Some have said, well, it's not really a big overhaul, but it's a step in the right direction. Like the name suggests, it's a first step. What's in it?
I agree. It is not the overhaul that the system desperately needs, but it is a, I would call it a next step, actually, because really this process in terms of addressing the problems in the federal criminal justice system has been going on for 10 years now. Many of those steps, the first steps occurred under President Obama. And he actually looked at this as a legacy issue for him. But this, I would characterize this as a next step in terms of trying to address the problems. So the bill is broken kind of down into two parts. The first part deals with revising federal sentencing laws and reducing mandatory minimums and giving judges more discretion to not have to sentence people to mandatory minimums. And then the second part of the law addresses people who are already in prison and allowing them to be released to halfway houses earlier based on whether or not they are a risk, a low minimal or minimal risk to recidivate. And so that's kind of the basic summary of the bill, of the law. It was passed out of the House in May. We did not support it at that point because it did not have the sentencing provisions. But once the sentencing provisions were added, we became supportive of the bill.
So does the House need to pass a new version? Is there going to be sort of a compromise process, or did the House already pass a version with that amendment?
So the House is expected to pass the same version of the bill that the Senate passed on Tuesday on Thursday.
Okay.
And then the bill will go to the president for signing.
Now, some called this bill a zombie bill, the bill that wouldn't die, because it sort of kept, almost not being passed. It went through many iterations. Is it sort of an unlikely journey to this point? Who would have thought that a criminal justice reform bill would come to fruition under a Republican president and a Republican-dominated House and Senate?
Right. So it is kind of a zombie bill because this the different iterations of this bill have been around for at least 5 years. There were, advocates and others around Washington and across the country have worked to push the different versions of the bill. And it is interesting because I think many of us thought that, including the Republicans, thought that a bill would not be passed in this Congress, considering kind of the rhetoric that this administration came in with in terms of and with the Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, who was vehemently opposed to criminal justice reform on the federal level. But it just goes to show you how advocacy can change things and circumstances can change things as well. And so now we're here And we have a bill that, again, I would say is not the generational change that many are characterizing it as in terms of criminal justice reform on the federal level, but really just the next step in the process of addressing the problems in the system.
Now, shouldn't we also frame this in terms of the federal prison population just being a fraction of the total prison population in the U.S., right? Isn't it that the majority of people incarcerated in this country are done so in state prisons?
That's absolutely correct. The federal prison system only incarcerates, and I shouldn't say only, that sounds strange because it's still a lot of people, 180,000 of the 2.2 million people who are incarcerated in this country are in the federal system. But the thing that is unique and disturbing at the same time about the federal system is that it the sentences are so harsh and so long, particularly around drug offenses, because almost 50% of the people that are in federal prison are there for drug offenses. And one of the provisions that was addressed in this bill that was passed on Tuesday by the Senate is a provision of federal law that allows for it's the equivalent of the three strikes and you're out provision that you've seen in state law, but it's purely focused on drug offenses in the federal system. And so if you have three drug felonies, you under current law, which will be changed soon, you could serve life in prison, life without parole in prison.
And so that leads me to the example of Alice Marie Johnson, this woman who was serving an inordinately long sentence for nonviolent drug offense and who became, in many ways, the figure whose story apparently moved President Trump. Tell us about her story and why it's important and how it was that, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that a reality TV star was able to speak the language of another reality TV star to use this story to move the president.
And yes, and we at the ACLU and many around the country have been aware of Alice Marie Johnson's story. Back 5 years ago, one of the things that we did at the ACLU is we published a report that entitled Life Without Parole, A Living Death, People Serving Life Without Parole Sentences for Nonviolent Offenses. And Alice Marie Johnson's story was one of the stories that we highlighted in that report in 2013. And that report was one of the things that brought attention to this problem on the federal level to President Obama. And one of the motivations for him to actually create the Clemency Initiative, which resulted in over 1,700 people having their sentences commuted in the federal system, many of which, over 500, were people serving life without parole sentences for drug crimes. And so I think we're all thankful that Kim Kardashian was able to highlight and bring to the president's attention these problems in the federal system through Alice Marie Johnson's case. But many of us who have been working on these issues have been aware of her case and have been advocating for her for years.
And Jared Kushner, who would have thought Jared Kushner would take on this issue? But apparently he took on the issue of criminal justice reform very early in his tenure at the White House. He is getting widespread praise, perhaps for the first, possibly the last time, during his time at the White House. What role did he play? And as far as you can tell, what's his motivation?
Sure. I mean, I have to give Jared Kushner credit because he has definitely kept this issue alive. Two years ago at this time, many people in Washington thought that criminal justice reform was dead. And Jared Kushner kind of came in and used his father's case as an example of why there needs to be reform in the federal system. And as many people are aware of, Jared's father was convicted and served time in federal prison for fraud and tax evasion. And he, as a son and a young person at the time of his father's incarceration, suffered or was aware of the effects that long-term incarceration, even though his father didn't serve that long, but incarceration in federal prison does to a family. And so those are experiences that he apparently never forgot. and has been motivated since he's been in Washington to have an effect on the federal system in particular.
And now you had, of course, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, sort of being pushed into or backed into a corner in having to support this bill, because then his president put his weight behind it. And he got, you know, the 87 out of 100 senators voting for this bill, which is quite remarkable. And I suppose it should be a good sign that some conservative Republicans opposed the bill. They didn't like it because it was not, you know, it was not conservative enough for them. So we got it. It's been passed in the Senate. Now, what lead or what sort of push factor could this bill and this act hopefully will, which will become law when Trump signs it, have on states? If the federal government is pushing to reform sentencing now, is it going to push states to do the same, particularly states that are Republican dominated?
And honestly, actually, the kind of dynamic is reversed. The reason why this happened on the federal level is because states recognized 10 years ago when the economy was in the recession that they had to do something about the cost of how much it was costing to incarcerate people on the state level. And so many states have already reform their systems because, again, in the state system, you have to have a balanced budget at the end of the day, and incarceration was one of the costs that was busting their budgets. And so, and what has happened is that the reforms on the state level have trickled up to the federal level, and that is one of the reasons why we even started talking about this reforming the federal system, because many state congressional delegations on the state level came back to Washington and said it can be done, and we can, if we did it in my hometown or my home state, like, for example, Texas, we can do it in Washington. And so it's actually been an opposite dynamic.
Are there very specific things that the federal government could do to push for states who might be reluctant or who actually need funds to make this happen? There's the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act that would provide grants to cut incarceration and crime to states from the federal government.
Yeah, and that's the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act is a law that we are a bill that we are very supportive of, and it would provide money and grants to states that show progress in terms of reducing their prison population, because even on the federal level, even though, for example, President Obama was not able to sign into law a more comprehensive criminal justice reform bill, his administration took many steps toward trying to address the problem in the federal level over the past 5 years. For example, back in five years ago in 2013, the federal prison population was 40% over capacity and about to top 220,000 people in federal prisons. And there were a number of different kind of policy changes that the administration supported that resulted in the 180,000 people in federal prison that we see today. And so so many of those policies are embodied in the reverse mass incarceration, or encouraging states to adopt many of those policies is embodied in the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act, which would also provide states with more money if they can show decreases in their prison populations.
So that could be a next step that, say, the House could take up next year under Democratic leadership?
Yep, absolutely.
Let's also talk about what is actually going about how this particular bill, the First Step Act, which was passed by the Senate on Tuesday. Do you see it, Jesslyn, as a racial justice and a gender justice issue? Aren't women among the fastest growing demographic in prisons, and aren't people of color just disproportionately incarcerated at the prison level?
Yes, and particularly in federal prison. We know that 70% or probably slightly over 70% of the people in federal prison are either black or brown people. And the First Step Act could do a lot more to address the racial disparities. It only scratches the surface in terms of addressing the racial disparities. But what it does do is it does provide more, it addresses some of the needs of women who are in federal prison. For example, one of the important provisions in the bill is that it prohibits the shackling of pregnant women, both while they're pregnant, but also postpartum, for 12 weeks after they have the baby. And that's a policy, for example, that honestly is on the books already at the Bureau of Prisons, but apparently is not being followed as it should. And even the policy that is currently at the Bureau of Prisons does not include postpartum prohibition on shackling of women. So that's a very important policy also. Another policy is what is called the Dignity Act, or pieces of the Dignity Act. And that's just those provisions that are in the bill focus on the simple task of providing sanitary products to women while they're in prison and not forcing them to pay for them through their commissary. And believe it or not, that is something that is a common practice in the Bureau of Prisons, the Federal Bureau of Prisons now. And what the bill would do is would ensure that women have those products and other kind of sanitary products so that they didn't have to pay for them out of their commissary account. And another provision I think that is important, does not just apply to women, but applies across the board, is a change in what is called the compassionate release policy. Currently, under law, if there is a extraordinary and compelling reason for a person to be resentenced or leave prison early to, for example, take care of a family member, or in most cases, it is because a person is extremely sick, terminally sick, and probably will not live much longer. They can be released by the Bureau of Prisons from their sentence, before their sentence is over. Mm-hmm. Well, under the bill, there's now a process where, because a lot of times the Bureau of Prisons will wait till what we call people are on their deathbed, basically, before they release them under the current compassionate release policy. Well, under the bill, there is a new updated compassionate release policy, which does not require the Bureau of Prisons to, first of all, file a motion with the court for a person to be released. It allows family members to do that, but it also forces the Bureau of Prisons to make a decision within 30 days as to whether or not they're going to release a person early. Because often, as I said, what has happened is the Bureau of Prisons has dragged their feet in terms of whether they're going to decide to release somebody, and that person gets released and dies a few days later.
Wow. So thank you for all that detail on these other bills that really are waiting in the wings to take maybe the second and third step after the First Step Act, which the Senate just passed. Some are saying that, and I want to go back to what Jared Kushner's motivation in supporting this bill was. The bill was also backed by the Koch brothers, and some are suggesting that because white collar crimes tend to be prosecuted in federal courts, that some corporate actors and wealthy elites are pushing for criminal justice reform of this sort because it might end up being offering leniency for white collar crimes. We already seem to imprison and incarcerate, and even for that matter, prosecute far too few white collar crimes. What do you make of this motivation?
I do think the Koch brothers were motivated by their own experience with regulatory criminal prosecution. But I think what has happened over the past, I would say probably five or six years or so, is they've learned more about the realities of federal prison and the fact that most people that are in federal prison are there, for example, for drug offenses or And most people in the federal system are there for drug offenses and immigration offenses. And so most people in the federal system are not there for white collar crime, even though a lot of people who have committed white collar crime do go to federal prison. But that's not the majority of the people that are in the system on the federal level. And I think it has been an education process for Jared Kushner, as well as the Kochs and many other conservative allies that you see supportive of this. And so I think that's why you see that, because the reality is the system is, there were problems with the system, but I think once you learn more about the system and see the unfairness, for example, like the three strikes law that was addressed in this bill, you understand that it's bigger than just white collar crime. It's bigger than just your, you know, the experiences of the Koch brothers or Jared Kushner's father in the system, that there are deeper, more significant problems that needed to be addressed.
Mm. So finally, Jocelyn, what are some next steps that the ACLU is going to be taking to build on this step in criminal justice reform? I know that the ACLU has for many, many years been working on this issue, as have many organizations around the country that you've partnered with. And this is a real, you know, serious issue, given that the United States is the leading country in the world in numbers of people incarcerated. It's really such a shameful stain on the nation internationally. So what's the next steps that ACLU will be taking?
Sure. Something, while I focus my efforts on the federal level, but we have what we call a campaign for smart justice that is going into, or just actually going into its fifth year, just started its fourth year, that has really honed in on addressing these problems on the state level. And we have developed blueprints for all 50 states to try to address the specific problems in each state that are actually trying to confront their own criminal justice systems. And so that effort has been going on for 4 years now. And we will continue that. And one of the things that I think has been brilliant about our work on the state level through the Campaign for Smart Justice is that Udi Ofer, who is our director of the campaign, took a step back and looked took a visionary step and look at the system itself and what the problems were. And what he came up with and started to understand is that on the state level particularly, on the federal level also, but on the state level particularly, one of the problems is the level of discretion that prosecutors have, and the fact that prosecutors hold so much power in the system that if you have a prosecutor that is not seeking justice and is not seeking fairness, that often leads to bad results for people in any particular jurisdiction, any particular state or locality. And so that is a new approach to reform that our campaign is taking, and I think is what is overdue, to look at kind of prosecutors' role in mass incarceration.
Well, Jocelyn, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for giving us all of this insight into what's just happened and what will happen next, hopefully. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn McCurdy is the deputy director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. We've been discussing the First Step Act passed by Congress. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.